Hey, here's something you should know. Some experts estimate that up to 77% of the population has some level of speaking anxiety. I actually thought it was higher than that. Strong communication is a critical skill for success, which is why I'd like to recommend a podcast I know you're going to love called Think Fast, Talk Smart, produced by the folks at Stanford Graduate School of Business. Think Fast, Talk Smart is the number one career podcast in over 95 countries, and here's why. Each week, Stanford lecturer Matt Abrahams, who, by the way, has been on this podcast a couple of times, Matt sits down with experts to discuss the best tips to help you improve all kinds of skills, from making small talk that leaves a big impression, keeping your nerves in check while speaking in front of crowds. I mean, there's a reason this show has over 42 million downloads and counting. You'll hear from people like neuroscientist Andrew Huberman on how to manage speaking anxiety, speechwriter and best-selling author Daniel Pink on how to take risks in your communication, and psychologist Kelly McGonigal on how to harness that nervous energy to fuel powerful presentations. All that and so much more is available on Think Fast, Talk Smart. So, what are you waiting for? Listen every Tuesday wherever you get your podcasts or on YouTube, and you can tell them I sent you. Today on Something You Should Know, want to know the secret to happiness? I'll tell you what happy people say it is. Then, all your life, people tell you no, and it's what you do with that no that really matters.
It's like you're going down a road and a tree falls across the road. Now, that tree is a no. So you say, what are all the possible ways I can either get around that no, over that no, under that no, or turn the no around and make it work for me?
Plus, the reality of going to live concerts. It's really not as much fun as we think it is. And why you need more friends and how to get them. And you probably do need more friends.
1 in 4 Americans have 0 friends to confide in, and this number has tripled in the last 30 years. 1 in 3 Americans above the age of 65, 1 in 2 above the age of 85 is socially isolated and completely alone.
All this today on Something You Should Know. If you employ people, you know that finding the right person to fill a job opening can be daunting. And, you know, most people I know who run a business don't really have a proven system to do this. It can be real hit or miss. Which is why if you're hiring, you need Indeed. 93% of employers agree that Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. Indeed is a whole hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates and find them fast. So what I love about Indeed is when you use it, you get this feeling of confidence that, yeah, this is the way to find the right people. You're not winging it or just sorting through resumes hoping to find someone. And Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from you. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. There are so many reasons to use Indeed, and there are so many reasons not to do this on your own. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/something. Just go to Indeed.com/something right now. That helps to support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/something. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Something you should know. Fascinating intel, the world's top experts, and practical advice you can use in your life. Today, Something You Should Know with Mike Carruthers.
Hi, welcome. And such a good thing you tuned in today because we're going to start with the secrets to happiness. For his book, The 5 Secrets You Must Know Before You Die, author John Izzo surveyed 250 truly happy people to find out what makes them so happy. And here's what they said. First, get outside yourself. Obsessive focus on oneself is one of the greatest sources of unhappiness. You can't be happy wallowing in your own problems. So go focus on something else or someone else. Stop judging your life. Life is not a contest. It's something to be enjoyed. So be in a place of gratitude and be thankful for all the things you do have and not worry about the things you don't have. Have no regrets. It's better to take a risk and fail than to never try and always wonder what if. And give more than you take. Do those things, and you'll be a lot happier. And that is something you should know. You know what stops people from finding success and getting what they want? Think about it. What stops you from getting what you want? The answer usually boils down to because someone says no. For some people, hearing no means no. It's upsetting, demoralizing, confidence-crushing. It's no. But maybe no doesn't always have to mean no. B.J. Gallagher is a speaker and prolific author with several books to her name. One of them is called Yes Lives in the Land of No. And she's here to talk about what to do with all those no's that will inevitably come your way in life. Hi, B.J., welcome. So you write about a lot of different topics. What attracted you to this?
I think trying to understand what makes human beings tick is probably the most fascinating subject, and it seems just endless. And so what attracted me to this particular topic was, why are some people more successful than others? And what is it that happens when people hear the word no? Why is it that some people are able to overcome that and keep going, and others go, that's it, I give up?
So why is that? Why is it that some people would take no as no and other people don't? And is it something that it's just part of who we are, or is it a learned behavior, or what?
I think it's some of both, but an awful lot of it is learned. It has to do with childhood conditioning and, you know, how your behavior was corrected and shaped and molded by the people who took care of you. But that's the good news, because it's learned means we can unlearn it and we can relearn some new habits that'll help make us more successful.
So it's really about how you process that word. When someone says no, what do you do with it?
Exactly. And what people, well, there's two kinds of people. Some people hear, when they hear no, what they hear is, you're an idiot, you're a failure, why did you bring me this idea, who do you think you are? If you need to have an opinion, I'll give it to you. Other people hear just the opposite. When they hear no, what they hear is, maybe later, I'm busy now, don't bother me, get me some more information, so that they hear a delay, but they don't hear a final answer.
Well, isn't that interesting that two people can hear the same person say no and hear two different things?
Well, first of all, not all no's are created equal. And we learn this as a lot of it comes from childhood. We learn this as children, because children are very good at pushing boundaries. And how those boundaries are reinforced makes a difference in how they deal with boundaries later on. You know, and it may also be that some of it is innate, that some children are more sensitive, feel less confident. I mean, we know that optimism and pessimism are behavior traits or sort of attributes that people, we're born with a certain disposition, but we can modify that disposition. So some people are naturally pessimists and some people are naturally optimists. But that doesn't mean you can't shape that and turn it around. So a pessimist, when he or she hears no, is going to go, oh, well, see, I knew, it's hopeless, no point in even trying. An optimist will say, well, I wonder why not. Maybe if I push a little bit, I can get them to change their mind. And sometimes even kids within the same family. I'm an optimist. My brother's a pessimist. And he hears no, he gives up. I hear no, and I think, let me get more creative.
So how does somebody who hears no the way your brother hears no move from that to hearing no the way you hear no as an optimist?
First of all, they have to believe that it's possible. So to turn no's into yeses, first of all, it's an inside job. You have to really, and it helps to see it in other people. Now, why is it that that person doesn't take no for an answer and they're successful? I take no for an answer and I'm not successful. What can I learn from them? So it helps to see somebody else doing it. And then you go, well, if they can do it, then maybe I can learn to do it. So you have to start to believe that it's possible. And seeing other people do it helps you know that it's possible. It's, you don't have to just take it on faith. You can actually see it in other people. That's the very first step. From then on, it's simply learning tools and techniques, developing thicker skin, becoming more of a long-distance runner rather than a sprinter in life. Just know that the yes is out there, but it may take you a long time to get to it.
So what are some of those tools and techniques?
Well, one of my favorites, I just have a simple word that I use, and that word is next. So when I get a rejection, like in the book publishing business, I send off book proposals all the time. I get a lot of rejection. In the beginning, when I got rejection, I would cry, get depressed, think nobody wants it. What I've learned to do, what I've taught myself to do, is instead of cry, get depressed, and complain, I simply say, oh, okay, next. What that means is I'm one no closer to the yes that I'm seeking. So basically, I reframed the situation.
Yeah, and I know a lot of salespeople think that way or learn to think that way, that I'm every no is one no closer to yes. But just for some reason, it's easier for some people than others to think that way.
Mm-hmm. Part of it, I think, also, Mike, is being creative. It's like you're going down a road and a tree falls across the road. Now, that tree is a no. You're not going to drive past the tree. So you say, well, I really want to get where I'm going. So what are my options? One option is I go around the tree. One option is I get some boards and I try to make a ramp up over the tree. Another is, a guy with a tow truck comes along and I get him to tow the tree out of the way. Or I just happen to have a chainsaw in my in the trunk of my car, so I get it out, chop it up, and not only do I get where I'm going, I load the wood in the back of my truck, and I sell it, I make some money off the no. So a lot of it is practicing divergent thinking. Seeing a no and saying, what are all the possible ways I can either get around that no, over that no, under that no, or turn the no around and make it work for me?
It sure makes you wonder why there are so many no's in the world. It's no this, no that. Everything is no.
It's safer and easier for people to say no. If you say no, it means you don't have to change. You don't have to do anything differently. You don't have to take a risk. Anytime, and to say yes means to roll up your sleeves and dig your hands into life when it's always safer to say no, even when no means death. That there's a part of all of us that wants to, even the most optimistic person, sometimes says no because I'm too tired or I don't want to change or it's too risky and I don't want to fail, I don't want to look stupid, or what does everybody else think? Well, if they say yes, then I'll say yes. But I don't want to be the first one to say yes because I might be wrong.
I'm talking with BJ Gallagher. She's the author of the book, Yes Lives in the Land of No. Are you one of those people who just buys things with whatever credit card you grab out of your wallet? Well, that could be a costly move. NerdWallet, you've heard of NerdWallet. NerdWallet lets you compare credit cards side by side to maximize your spending. So if, for example, you like travel rewards, you can see which credit card gives you better rewards than the credit card you've got now. Think of what you could do with better rewards. Free flight, room upgrades, who knows? Compare and find smarter credit cards, savings accounts, and so much more at nerdwallet.com. NerdWallet, finance smarter. Credit is subject to lender approval and terms of each credit card issuer apply. Now, your ideas don't have to wait. Now they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas, loves expanding your business, evolving your passions. We push what technology can do, so great ideas can happen right now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com/welcome to now. So, BJ, sometimes you'll hear a no, though. Like, you'll have a good idea and try to convince somebody you have a good idea, and they'll say no, because maybe it isn't a good idea. And to keep banging your head against the wall trying to sell this good idea may be a big waste of time.
That's a really good point you raised there, Mike. And that's a tough question. When is no final? And when, as I said, not all no's are created equal. And sometimes no is the right answer. Sometimes no can keep you from doing something stupid or something really dangerous. But there's no hard and fast rules to know when that is. You just have to sort of learn by experience which no's are worth doing battle with and which no's aren't. It has to do with how much you believe in what you're after, what your passion is, what your tolerance for pain is. I mean, sometimes you just run out of steam and say, oh, I give up. I wish I had a very clear, simple guideline to give you on that, but I don't. Sometimes no is the right answer. So we just learn a lot, like we learn most of life, from trial and error. You just try again and try again and try again, and then after a while you learn which no's to challenge and which ones to let go. You know, if I send a book proposal out and 20 publishers reject it, I say, well, okay, there's another 30 publishers out there. I think I'll keep trying. Or I might say, maybe it's not such a good book proposal after all. Maybe I'll just go write something else instead. But it depends. It really depends on how passionate I am about the idea. That the classic story there is the guys who wrote Chicken Soup for the Soul got rejected by 53 publishers, just about every publisher there was. Their literary agent fired them and said, I'm sorry, I can't sell this book called Chicken Soup for the Soul. Nobody wants to read anthologies. I'm done. And they found one little tiny publisher in Florida who said, okay, we've been wanting to try something different. We'll try your little anthology. And now, 100 million books later, the rest is history. One of my favorite quotes is by Thomas Edison. He says, I have not failed. I've simply found 10,000 ways that didn't work.
And that's a great way to be able to look at it because, you know, some people would stop at 5,000 or 100 or 1. I mean, it's tough to imagine working on something and trying it 10,000 different ways and still keep trying.
And it's a very personal decision. Only you can decide how many no's you're willing to go through to get your yes. How important is that yes? And the yes may be different. It may be the yes you're looking for in a job promotion is going to be very different than the yes you're looking for in the right house to buy or the right person to marry or whether or not to have a third child. I mean, you know, it's not all yeses are created equal either.
Now, I know you say that dealing with the topic of no is very important at work and in dealing with your boss. Why so?
Bosses are the people who probably say no more often than anyone else. They have people who work for them. They have people who want something. They want a raise. They want attention. They want time. They want approval on a project. Bosses have a lot of people making demands on them, and therefore they say no a lot more than the rest of us do. They're just in a position to say no more than the rest of us. The first thing to think about if your boss is the person who says no to you most often is, where is the no coming from? Because that boss's no may be driven by fear. Like, don't make me look bad. I don't want to take a risk. It may be driven simply by busyness. I've got too much on my plate already. I can't handle another project. It may be driven by laziness. I don't want to work hard. So the more I know about my boss, the more I can manage the boss and manage my way around those no's. For instance, if my boss is driven by fear, then the no's I get are also going to be driven by fear. So my job is to reassure the boss that doing what I'm asking is actually going to be less risky than doing nothing. If the boss's no is driven by, this might make me look bad, then my challenge is to point out how saying yes will make the boss look good, and saying no might make them look bad. So I really have to understand what's behind the no before I can turn that no around with my boss.
And do you think that's easy for people to figure out?
I think it is. The key to bosses is just, first of all, not taking them personally. You know, too many of us turn our bosses into our parents. And then when the boss says or does something, it hurts our feelings. Women are particularly susceptible to this, much more than men, that we over-personalize things. So first of all, you know, whatever your boss says, no, don't take it personally. It's not personal. It's just business. And then to really watch, listen, ask questions, and your boss is always giving you signals about what's important to him or her. You can tell by what's in your boss's office. If your boss has lots of diplomas and awards and degrees and things like that, that boss is oriented by power and achievement. And if you know that about the boss, then you can point out how giving you a yes will help get them more power. Because the question is always what's in it for them. If, on the other hand, your boss has pictures of the company softball team, pictures of their pets, their family, seascapes, bowls of flowers, things like that, that boss is motivated by achievement. I'm sorry, by affiliation. And that boss needs to be popular. They want to be loved more than they want to be respected. And so you say, well, if we do this, boy, it's really going to win points with the troops. So you use that. Another signal is to watch for data. Data on a boss's wall, like charts, graphs, maps, sales figures, things like that. That boss is really oriented by achievement more than anything else. The three things that bosses are motivated by are power, affiliation, and achievement. So once you know that, then you've got that leverage, and you simply speak their language to turn that no around.
It does seem, though, that some people are better at sizing up people the way you just described. Some people are, like salespeople, are better at that, I think, than I am.
And see, salespeople, they are amateur psychologists. Some of them are even professional psychologists. And children are pretty good at sizing people up. You know, children are just really intuitive. They pay a lot of attention to the giants around them because their survival depends on their ability to manipulate the people around them, the big people around them. The rest of us somehow have forgotten that, but if we could relearn, like here's another thing to know about your boss. Is your boss a reader or a listener? Simply knowing that can transform your relationship with your boss. Because the bottom line is bosses need information. They need to be informed. They don't like surprises. But how you get that information to your boss makes all the difference. If your boss is a reader and you go in and you're just chatting and talking all the time, the boss isn't going to get the information he or she needs. And you can tell because their eyes glaze over. And you go, oh, he's not listening anymore. If, on the other hand, your boss is a listener, and I've learned this the hard way, Mike, the last boss I had in a large organization was a reader and not a listener. And so he was a listener and not a reader. But I'm a reader. So I was sending him emails and reports and memos all the time, and I got back nothing. I got silence, and I thought, what's wrong? I'm trying to keep him informed. I'm leaving a paper trail. What am I doing wrong? And what I suddenly realized, you know, there's that old saying, we teach what we need to learn. And I realized, oh, he's a listener. He's not a reader. He didn't want to read anything longer than one page. He wanted me to come down and brief him. He wanted to argue about it. He wanted to debate. He was a verbal, oral person. He wasn't a visual person. He wasn't a reader. Once I realized that and I quit sending him all the memos, our relationship improved dramatically.
Do you have any other ways that people can maybe read their boss better?
Another thing to pay attention to is energy level. We all have biorhythms. There are certain times of the day when we're more energetic, we're more alert than others. So pay attention. Is your boss a morning person? Is your boss an afternoon person? Is your boss a night owl? Timing is everything. Timing can be the single reason why you get a no instead of a yes. You just hit the boss at the wrong time. So by paying attention to when is the boss most receptive, in the morning when he's got his coffee, is he in there at 6 a.m., or is your boss someone who's better in the afternoon after she's had lunch and she's relaxed? Timing is everything.
You know, it really seems like the message is that if you want someone to say yes, it isn't just about what you want them to say yes to. It's about understanding who they are, the situation you're in, the time of day, the type of person they are. All of those factors collectively make a big difference as to whether or not you're going to get a yes or a no. BJ Gallagher has been my guest. The book is Yes Lives in the Land of No, and you'll find a link to that book in the show notes for this episode. Thanks, BJ. Statistically speaking, we have fewer good friends today than people did 25 years ago. Good friends as in people you can confide in, not social media friends, but real close, be in the same room kind of personal friends. I know I don't have as many friends as I used to. I know a lot of people who can say that same thing. When I just look around, I mean, I don't know my neighbors like my parents knew their neighbors. We are seemingly more isolated, and given that human beings are social creatures, this is probably not such a good thing. One person who's trying to do something about this is Radha Agrawal. She's an entrepreneur, investor, inventor, speaker, and lifelong community builder. She founded Daybreaker, which is a grassroots early morning dance phenomenon that began in 2013 as a social experiment. She's also the author of a book called Belong: Find Your People, Create Community, and Live a More Connected Life. Hi, Radha. So you're clearly a big proponent of people being more connected, having close friends, and being part of a community. So why do you think this is so important?
I mean, it is the human experience. It is in our DNA to belong, and we cannot actually survive as a species without it. I mean, think about it. Cheetahs and bears are stronger and faster than we are. But we're at the top of the food chain because we're the best at collaborating. We're the best at skill sharing. We're the best at storytelling. So
if we're programmed to belong, if we're required by nature to be part of groups, that why is it so hard? Why do people have such a difficult time today making friends?
Because we don't know how to make friends anymore. I mean, we haven't prioritized communities. I mean, if you think about it, when was the last time you wrote down a list of the qualities you're looking for in a friend, right? We do this for our romantic lives, right? We write down what we're looking for in a romantic partner. We write down what we're looking for in a professional career. We do all these exercises for ourselves in those areas, but we rarely, if ever, do them for our friendships.
Well, I think one of the problems people have, I remember a time in my life where I thought, you know, I wish I had more friends. And I sat down and thought about, well, how do you do that?
Exactly.
Where do you go? So dive into that. How do you do that? How do you make friends? Because when you go and ask somebody, will you be my friend?
I mean, it's almost like that, right? But I bought every book I could find on community building when I started building my own community, Daybreaker, which is now, you know, 500,000 people in 25 cities around the world. And I've spent now the last, you know, 10 years of my career building communities. But what I realized in buying all the books that I could find was that they all ask the question or answer the question, why is it important to belong, right? Why is community important? But none of them actually really talked about how do we belong? So I really wanted to offer that, you know, those tips and tools. And so to belong, it starts with a deep adventure within, right? You have to go in to go out is my mantra for making friends and building community. And I think so often in this journey, we're looking outside of ourselves. We're saying, who's out there who can be my friend? How can I make a friend today to go to the movies with, without asking ourselves, wait a minute, do they align with my values, my interests, my abilities? Are they really connected to what I'm connected to? You know, how can I actually spend some time getting gooey and comfortable with myself first? Really take the time to go inside of ourselves before we get out there and look for our friendship. So, for example, you know, one of the things I ask you to do is write down the five people with whom you're spending the most time with today and ask yourself, are they grandfathered in? Are they bringing you up? Are they bringing you down? Is your only friend your spouse? One of the things I noticed, and of course the stats prove that as well, is when I ask men in particular, older men, who their best friend is, all of them say it's their wife. And then when I say, well, when you remove your wife, who else is there that you can confide in? And particularly the older demographic, they don't have any because they've been taught to grow a pair. You know, you don't need anybody. You're fine on your own. Emotions, what's that? Vulnerability, why? And then now add a layer of digital, add a layer of social media onto the mix, and now we're even more confused and lost than ever. So women and men, not to mention women, are comparing themselves more than ever online and having these sort of judgment moments because of social media, and it inflames us. And so social media has made us much more sensitive. Look how politically polarized our country is, and just, you know, how quick we are to write off our friends. Oh, they made one mistake in the comment they made. I'm never speaking to them again. We're just very, very sensitive. We've forgotten how to forgive each other. We've forgotten how to have nuanced conversations. And so one of the things that I'm really passionate about is getting back to the basics of, wait, what is the most important thing to survive and thrive? And that is to belong.
As you said, though, older people especially, when you ask them about their friendships, they say, you know, emotions, what's that? If you were to tell an older person or any person who really hasn't connected on this, that you need to go on a journey within and you need to look inside, and people are going to go, what? You know, I mean, I don't even know what that really means.
So let's do this exercise together. So step one is write down three columns. Just draw three columns. Column one is, what are all the qualities I'm looking for in a friend? So I want friends to talk about ideas and not each other. I want friends who are interesting and interested. I want friends who go to the gym and like to work out and think of wellness as an important part of their day. I want friends who say F yes and lean in to life and adventure. I want friends who are enthusiastic and playful. Right, so I wrote down all these qualities looking for in a friend. And then column two was all the qualities I didn't want in a friend. I didn't want shoulder shruggers. I didn't want negative Nellies, Netflix and chills, or, you know, chillers. I didn't want negativity and so on and so forth. Wrote down everything. And column three, perhaps the most important column, was all the qualities that I needed to embody in order to attract the friends that I wanted. So I needed to be less of a workaholic, right? I had to put down my laptop and stop canceling on my friends and being a flake. I was named most flaky friend at our Christmas party 4 years ago. And I just couldn't believe that I'm a community builder who is also flaky, you know? So I now had to turn the mirror on myself. Like, what was my energy when I showed up, when I walked in the door somewhere? Was I bringing people up or bringing people down? What was my energy like? So really facing myself was a really wonderful first step. And those three columns were the beginning of a life-changing 30s. And from 30 to 39, I mean, it's just a 180-degree difference from feeling lost and alone to feeling sort of in deep community, intentional, and having found my tribe.
Okay, so I understand, you know, what you want in a friend, what you don't want in a friend, what you bring to the friendship, those three columns. That's great. But at some point, you have to go out and actually meet people. So where do you go? What's that process?
The first thing I ask you to do is just plot out a list of communities that you want to explore that align with your values, your interests, and your abilities, right? So today, my interests are, I love music festivals, I love social entrepreneurship, I love family stuff because I'm 8 months pregnant right now, so I'm very interested in parenting. So these are all my interests. So then I started, okay, plotting out, what are the different communities that I can connect with that align with these interests? and then I begin exploring them, not just as a bucket list experience where you're like, I checked it off my list, but something that you return to time and time again. That participation is such an important part of belonging, which is why church has been such a critical part of our history for thousands of years, because you're going there every Sunday. Every Sunday you're seeing the same community members. Every Sunday you feel a sense of belonging, and that sense of home.
You know, as I listen to you, it occurs to me, and I want you to comment on this, that one of the reasons perhaps that people have trouble making friends is that listening to your process sounds, well, in some ways sounds like a lot of work, and in other ways sounds very deliberate. Whereas when I look back at the people in my life that have been friends over the years, it wasn't a deliberate process. They were just people that I ran into that were friends of friends, or you meet them on the train or whatever, that become friends, and they may not even have the characteristics that if I really sat and thought about it, I'd want in a friend, but somehow they're just friends. It just, in other words, that friendship just happens.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, this is why I would say, first of all, you're one of the lucky ones, but 1 in 4 Americans have 0 friends to confide in, and this number has tripled in the last 30 years. 1 in 3 Americans above the age of 65, 1 in 2 above the age of 85 is socially isolated and completely alone. So yes, I mean, there's of course lucky cases where you might happenstance meet people. I mean, you've interviewed thousands of people for this podcast. I'm sure many of them must have turned into friends, you know. But yeah, you're one of the lucky ones. But 25 to 50% of the population aren't so lucky. And so we have to take that time to get intentional about our tribe. And ultimately, as research has shown from Harvard, that is the single most important thing we will ever do in our lives to be healthy and wealthy and live life longer, right? Like the longest living communities, what we call the blue zone communities, the Okinawans, the Sardinians, the Seventh-day Adventists, the Costa Ricans, they live the longest and they live the healthiest because of their communities. Again, Harvard has tied isolation to be as harmful to your physical health as being an alcoholic and twice as harmful as obesity. So it's clear that our isolation is killing us and it's making us sick.
Depending on where you live, though, and maybe not depending on where you live, identifying those people and those groups that you might want to be part of their community might be difficult to do. So how do you, in a very practical way, how do you find these groups to go check out?
Step one, again, once you go inside and write down your interests, like what are you interested in doing, then now you go to Meetup.com. You go to, I don't know if you've heard of Meetup, but Meetup is a wonderful website that has hundreds of thousands of communities organized by city, by what you're interested in. And so you can go on Meetup.com. You can go on Facebook groups, find them. This is where the online world can be beautiful, but don't stay on there and get caught. And that's what happens. We get caught in the endless scroll. But go on there tactically and surgically. Go and find the communities that that align with your values and your interests, and then start showing up. Like, that's literally it. It's just showing up. Last night at a book event here in Washington, D.C., where I am right now, and 80 people showed up. And you know, they didn't have to, but they came and we had this wonderful evening. No one knew each other. And by the end of it, we had set up a Facebook group. Now we're adding everybody on there. They're all going to meet up with each other. We had breakouts and everyone met and connected. So it's just really about saying yes to things, putting your shoes on and going, and basically stopping your limiting beliefs that what is life for if not for trying new things, if not for getting out of my comfort zone, if not for removing the mean girls of our mind, which I talk about a lot. The mean girls, or in the male case, you know, mean boys of our mind are comparison, judgment, and perfectionism. We compare ourselves, we judge ourselves, and then we continue nitpicking ourselves as perfectionists and each other as a result. So, you know, we sit with these mean girls in the cafeteria of our minds every day, not realizing that that's actually the default of what it means to be an animal. We have to actively go and sit with the Soul Sisters, which are the opposite of the Mean Girls. So the opposite of comparison is inspiration. Be inspired by those people, right? And the opposite of perfectionism is gratitude. Be grateful for the people around you, not nitpicking what they're doing wrong, right? The opposite of judgment is curiosity. Why am I being judgmental of this person or myself or this moment or this thing that I'm about to do? Just get out there and do it. My most depressed friend said to me, you know, the single most salient and potent thing that got me out of my depression was this one word, and it was curiosity. My mother, for example, she's 70 years old. This is 2 weeks ago. This is an incredible story. She's Japanese, English is her second language. She speaks like this, hello, I'm from Japan. And she moved to Baltimore a month ago, didn't know a single person. Instead of sitting at home and wallowing in self-pity and watching Netflix and saying, I don't know anybody, she wrote a handwritten letter that just said, hi, my name is Mirei. I just moved to the neighborhood. I don't know anybody. I'd like to make some Japanese lady friends, and not male friends. I'm happily married, but I want to make some Japanese lady friends, and here's my phone number. If you want to be my friend, please give me a call. And then she courageously drove that letter to the closest Japanese restaurant in the neighborhood, gave it to the general manager. I'm not even kidding. General manager of the Japanese restaurant said, excuse me, if you meet some Japanese ladies, please show them this letter. And the following week, her phone has not stopped ringing off the hook.
That's a great story.
Three dates already, and I just was so stoked for her, you know?
You know what's interesting, I was talking about this not long ago, that it is interesting that it does seem as we get older, friends fall away. They disappear. They, for whatever reason, and probably lots of different reasons in different cases, but it does seem that, you know, I have fewer friends than I used to. I had a million friends when I was in school, and where'd they go?
Right. So because here's exactly what happened. You stopped prioritizing friendships. You said to me 10 minutes ago, well, you're supposed to just make friends happenstance. Like, I don't think it feels so surgical to be able to have to, you know, take the time to do it. But that's the beauty of life, right? Like, that's what, you know, the older I get, I'm almost 40. I'm going through the process of motherhood. It's a whole new journey for me. All my friends are much younger than me. I'm one of the first ones in my community to have a baby. So it's a completely new community for me too. So in many ways, Mike, I'm starting over as well, right? But it's up to you, Mike, if, you know, I don't have as many friends as before. You could have if you wanted to prioritize it, right? And I think that's really where it gets exciting, where we get to push each other to say, oh, right, I haven't been prioritizing it. I have been only prioritized, or I've been so focused on my family and my kids and raising them, but now it's my turn again. They're grown up, they're out of the house.
This whole subject of, you know, making friends, not having enough friends, wishing you had more friends, wishing you belonged, nobody really talks about it. It's like taboo.
For some reason in our society, it's shameful to say, I don't belong, I don't have friends. So we hide behind terms like I'm introverted, I'm extroverted, I'm socially anxious. We hide behind all of these terms because we're ashamed of it. So it doesn't matter how popular you are on social media. We all go through this journey of, my gosh, where are my friends at? And it's time that we stop shaming ourselves and being embarrassed about it. Just saying, hey guys, I'm in a new period of my life. I'm just making new friends right now. Let's get together and play, you know, play cards or whatever it is and hang out and go to the movies. And I'm starting a group. And if anybody wants to join, like, join with me. There's so many simple steps that you can take to starting a community and having the courage. The single most generous act we can do as human beings is to create community. That is it. That is the single most generous act we can do, is to create community for ourselves, for each other, because when we create community for ourselves, we are happier, we are healthier, we are less anxious, we are less depressed, we are more likely to hear each other, more likely to forgive each other. So for ourselves to create community is so generous.
It's such a good point you make that, you know, there is this shame around it. We can't talk about it. Gee, I wish I had more friends. Will you be my friend? But we don't. We can't. But maybe now, after listening to you, we can. Radha Agrawal has been my guest. She is an entrepreneur, a lifelong community builder, founder of Daybreaker, and author of the book Belong, Find Your People, Create Community, and Live a More Connected Life. There's a link to her book in the show notes. Thanks, Radha.
Thanks, Mike. It's been a deep pleasure to be with you on this podcast.
Have you ever had that left out feeling because all your friends are going to the big sold out concert and you're not? Well, instead of being sad, maybe you should rejoice, according to Sam Parker of Esquire magazine. Going to a concert, almost any concert, is objectively a horrible experience, and here's why. Parking is almost always a nightmare, and it's always expensive, and getting out of the parking lot takes just as long as the concert itself. The concert almost always starts late, but the tickets tell you to get there insanely early. The result is this endless stretch of time with nothing to do except buy overpriced drinks and overpriced merchandise. The sound is usually too loud and terrible. Concert venues typically have horrible acoustics. As the concert goes on, your fellow audience members become drunker and more obnoxious. And there are really only so many great seats in the house, and you're probably not sitting in one of them. A lot of the music that the band plays you've never heard before and probably don't ever care to hear again. And when they finally do play your favorite song from 10 years ago, it never sounds as good as the recording that you've come to love. Then, when it's all over, we tell ourselves and everyone else how great it was. But as Mr. Parker from Esquire says, nowhere in life is there such a gulf between what we tell ourselves about an experience and what the experience is actually like. So if you don't get to go to the concert, take comfort, because what you think you missed is probably better than what you really missed. And that is something you should know. Ratings and reviews are always welcome. They only take a moment, and they really do make an impact and help us out. I'm Mike Carruthers. Thanks for listening today to Something You Should Know.